just getting up or just getting out the door, we get it. Life in SoCal isn't always 9 to 5. That's why this morning team is going strong at the crack of dawn for you. Shauna, her forecast will tell you what to wear. Alicia, her down-to-the-mile traffic will keep you in the clear. Whit and Daniela, they'll break down all the morning's breaking news, so nothing takes you by surprise. It's simple. You wake up, we'll open your eyes. Today in LA for you. Now, starting at 4 a.m.
Blog Talk Radio.
Je vous écoute. Je vous écoute. Live, several miles from Hollywood. It's Advice Goddess Radio. With nationally syndicated advice columnist Amy Alcorn.
Hello, welcome. This is syndicated columnist Amy Alcon with Advice Goddess Radio. Nerd your way to a better life with the best brains in science. Now, I want to open tonight by mentioning Rule 34. That's the name for the internet rule that says if something exists, there's porn of it, just a browser window away. As Felix Clay writes on craft.com, and by something, we mean anything, literally anything you may have seen or heard of before. Nazis, golden grams, hair bears, amputee hillbillies, the Koch brothers, whatever. Well, my guest tonight has presumably viewed 3 tons of porn, but most people can't say this about their porn viewing. It's all been in a day's work for him. On tonight's show, I'll be talking to Dr. Jesse Baring. He's author of the mind-opening book, Perv, The Sexual Deviant in All of Us. Join us as Jesse Baring explains how our sexual desires seem to be shaped, how sexually not normal some of the most seemingly normal people are, and how human psychology leads us to find other sex practices upsetting and creepy instead of just different from our own. Hello, Jesse.
Hi, Amy. How are you?
Hey, great. I'm so glad you're here. I've been wanting to do this for a while. I even blurbed your book. And your book is basically, you're welcome, about erotic outliers, you know, the different weird people. But you write that we all have more in common with the average pervert than we may be aware.
Right. So erotic outliers is kind of the polite term, I suppose, for pervert. Pervert is such a loaded word. So this is the phraseology that I adopted for the book. Took a little bit of the sting out of sexual deviant, I think.
I like to actually have a book like that. I used to take it to a bar as a joke. I can't remember what the whole title is, Sexual Deviance and Sexual Deviancy. You know, it starts some conversations. But you talk about, there's a quote from you, humans aren't the only sex deviants in the animal kingdom, but we are the only ones to stigmatize each other as disgusting perverts. And Kinsey, in 1948, Kinsey, the sex researcher, he wrote about the penalties for this, and these include imprisonment, torture, the loss of life or limb, banishment, blackmail, social ostracism, the loss of social prestige, renunciation by friends and families, loss of position in school or business. He goes on and on and on. And the problem is, he says, these are the penalties which have been imposed on and against people who have done no damage to the property or physical bodies of others, but have failed to adhere to mandated customs. And this is a big deal for you. You get into the harm factor. So you look at, you know, is this practice harmful to somebody? Are we not consenting adults, or is it somehow otherwise harmful? Talk a little bit about that.
So like Kinsey, you know, I never found the arguments about a particular sexual behavior or practice being unnatural or being abnormal, and therefore we shouldn't be doing it, to be terribly convincing. For me, the bigger question was really looking at this issue of harm, identifying harm, being able to appreciate the fact that people are different in terms of what arouses them and what disgusts them, what turns them off and what turns them on, and being able to take the perspective of somebody else, which is oftentimes very difficult when we're thinking about sexual deviance. And moving away from that sort of naturalistic framework and more to this harm-based model. So Kinsey was doing that all the way back in the 1940s and 1950s. And when he was writing about those penalties for sexual deviance, I think he had in mind primarily homosexuality, to be honest, because back then, of course, to be a gay man or to be a lesbian and to be in an open relationship like that was simply not socially tolerated. and one faced significant social penalties as a consequence of that. Today it's quite different, so I do think we've made progress when it comes to thinking about same-sex behaviors, more homosexuality, but we're still grappling, I think, with all sorts of other minority sexual orientations where harm is similarly less than apparent.
Yeah, and that's a big thing you bring in throughout the book. But I want to get a little bit into what you just mentioned. It's actually called the naturalistic fallacy. It's the notion that something is natural is okay. It is a fallacy because, for example, poison mushrooms are natural. And you talk about how some atheists defend homosexuality using this point that it occurs in nature. Now, I just think that they're sort of grasping for that. But you point out that sex acts with reproductively immature juveniles, as you call them, enforced sex are also found in nature far more than homosexuality, and we don't think these are okay.
Right. I think that we'd be, you know, it'd be difficult to make the argument that just because bonobos, for instance, are engaging in sexual behaviors with juvenile members of the species, therefore pedophilia is okay for human beings. But we do find that argument being adopted for same-sex behaviors in human beings. We oftentimes hear that claim that bonobos have sex with you know, the same sex, a GG rubbing, genital rubbing between two adult female bonobos. And we look at that and we say, well, look, they do it. You know, therefore, it's natural to a closely related species of primate. Therefore, it should be okay for us too. But that's the naturalistic fallacy. What is natural is therefore okay. It doesn't really apply that cleanly to some of the less palatable types of sexual behaviors.
And now you also point out that what is harmful to one person is completely harmless to another. And you talk about in the book, you're a gay man, and you give the rather hilarious example of the possibility of supermodel Kate Upton walking to your office and, well, I guess I'll just say it, basically sitting on your face. And you write about this, I think I'd require therapy for years. But you suspect
that would be a nightmare
very
scenario for me, yes.
Right. It'd be different for your heterosexual brother or one of your lesbian friends. So the harm is really different.
Right. For me, I might have some sort of post-traumatic stress disorder after an incident like that. But for your average heterosexual male, it would be a dream come true. So it's very difficult, and I understand this, for a completely straight male to appreciate the fact that I'm attracted to other men. But likewise, I have a difficult time doing that for straight men looking at women. So it's imperative, I think, it's morally imperative for us to be able to step outside of our own shoes and to evaluate the sex act from the perspective of the individual engaging in the behavior.
Now, one thing that prevents that is you talk about how we all keep these sexual secrets. And so what's really sexually common is seen to be sexually weird. And this is something everybody, you know, thinks that nobody else is doing the thing that they're doing, but it probably is more common than they think.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, one of the reasons I wrote the book was to get at these sort of secrets, I suppose, these secretive aspects of human sexuality, which is inevitable when the research methodologies involve surveys and self-reports and questionnaires where you're simply asking people to share information that's incredibly stigmatized. They might not have even, you know, admitted it to themselves. And even when they're told that it's an anonymous survey, for instance, you're still going to get a lot of people that are erring on the side of caution and either giving you the socially appropriate response or what they think you want to hear, and keeping things from you as the researcher. So there's no good way to get around that from an empirical or scientific perspective in terms of gathering those data. The best way to do it, I think, is through laboratory research that involves some sort of fairly invasive physiological arousals of measures of arousal, where you look at men getting erections, for instance, or women getting lubricated as a consequence of being sexually excited. But not everybody's, of course, going to sign up for those types of studies.
Right, and that's the problem, too. There's a selection bias. And this is called, I should have looked this up and how to pronounce it and train for it. It's the thing that Cindy Chivers uses, or is it Meredith Chivers, that she uses?
Meredith,
it measures plasmid. Tell us what it's called, because I won't be able to say
it's the penile plethysmograph.
Thank you.
Is basically sort of an erection detection measurement device. It's very sensitive in terms of detecting very subtle degrees of tumescence. levels of erection that the male consciously wouldn't experience and wouldn't be aware of the fact that he was getting aroused. And in the female model of that sort of technique is vaginal vasocongestion.
Right. And now, see, as a libertarian who is very worried about the government looking at basically pre-crimes, as that one movie talked about, you talk about something scary where, you know, of course, pedophiles, people who do these horrible acts on children are terrible people, and we want to catch them. But, you know, there's a civil liberties line, and that, you know, where, you know, there's this idea that maybe the government or somebody would put this kind of device on somebody to see. Because you can reliably tell with men, women, we'll talk about this later, how women are just about attracted to everything, and there's a reason for that. But that
or at
with
least
men,
genitally aroused.
Right, good, well put. That's why you wrote the book. That they could attach this plethysmograph to men who say, oh, no, I don't like little girls or little boys, and that those men would become aroused by them in a way where, quote unquote, you know, the majority of the population, mm-hmm. they're not going to be aroused by pictures of little children, and so
right.
that could be a way of finding, quote unquote, pre-crime.
Right. So these types of measurement devices are used most commonly actually in forensic situations. So after somebody's already committed a crime involving children, more than likely they'll be subjected to some sort of forensic assessment to evaluate their degree of arousal to children, to prepubescent children or pubescent children, versus their arousal level to adults. And that's actually quite useful for forensic purposes, because those true pedophiles that actually have already committed some sort of crime and clinically are diagnosed as pedophiles, we know from the actual data that they are more likely to reoffend in the future. So it's useful information to have in terms of reducing harm to children and the recidivism rates. But it becomes slippery as just simply a laboratory tool, for instance, and just trying to get a figure that represents the proportion in the population that is attracted to different types of individuals at different age levels, for instance, because simply by, you know, getting an erection is not a crime in and of itself. So it's important to separate desires from actual harmful behaviors.
Yeah, and you make this point in your book, Perv, and I am talking with Dr. Jesse Baring. His book is Perv, the Sexual Deviant in All of Us. And you make so many good points. One of them, and this relates to people who have desires that are things they shouldn't act on, like pedophilia, that you talk about the Wegener effect, the white bear. Tell us about that and what happens when people try to suppress their sexual thoughts or other thoughts?
Well, Dan Wegener, who unfortunately died fairly recently, was a very prominent social psychologist at Harvard University, and he studied, he's best known for this white bear effect phenomenon involving thought suppression, that if you actively try to suppress thoughts, those thoughts actually become more intense and stronger and more recurrent in your cognition. So the white bear terminology refers to the fact that if you tell somebody, try as hard as you can not to think of a white bear, inevitably a white bear pops into people's minds even more often by virtue of the fact that they're trying not to think about it. So something similar is believed to happen when you're trying to eradicate unwanted sexual desires or socially inappropriate erotic responses. If you tell somebody, don't think like that, it's basically just going to make it worse. Those thoughts are going to be more frequent. It's going to be much more of a problem for the individual.
Right. And I read on this, and what I read was that when you tell your brain to not think of something, your brain goes around to check, you know, it's like the hall monitor mm-hmm. to see if you've been thinking about it, and that's already a thought. And that what seems to work, and I bet this research is not passed on to people with these sort of problems, that what's better to think is that it's hard to not think about something, but you're going to try. And because it is just awful, this thing of, you know, don't suppress your sexual thoughts, and then it'll backfire, and it'll just be, and then you feel terrible that you haven't been able to suppress them when this is sort of a self-fulfilling prophecy.
Right, you'll feel like you're just simply incapable of doing something that you should be able to do, which is to stop thinking about something that would be harmful. And it doesn't quite work that way. I mean, really the only way to eliminate somebody's sexual desires, and if they've got a psychosexual orientation that gravitates them to a particular type of individual, for instance, or a particular sexual behavior or activity, is to give them some sort of psychopharmacological medication where their libido is eliminated, and you basically render them asexual. That's the only conditions under which the actual lustful desires, at least, are going to be watered down. And even the thoughts themselves still might be there, but they just wouldn't be fueled by any sort of sexual desire at that point.
Yeah, if I had that desire, I would for sure take some sort of drug. That's so horrible.
Chemical castration. Yeah, absolutely.
Right. People are compelled, you know, often, and compelled is a bad word. They act, those who act on children, I mean, it's just such a horrible thing. But you do talk about in your book, you talk about the nuances, and you say, you know, you also, you're, you know, no condoner of any of this horrible stuff, but you say, you do say, our moral evaluation should fall upon harmful sexual actions with the heaviest of thuds, but that we mistakenly conflate sexual desires and sexual behaviors. And you talk about the better safe than sorry bias, where there's a prejudice against someone on the basis of their nature, not a decision based on anything the person has done or will seem to do. So there seems to be a little danger in there, but talk a little bit about that.
Well, I think it sort of falls on this construct of sexual orientation. What is an orientation? And I use that word in the book in a way that most clinical psychologists probably wouldn't. I'm not a clinical psychologist, so I could probably think outside of the box here a little bit when I'm using that word. But for me, an orientation sexually is basically anything that your brain or your genitals are orienting to. It's as straightforward as that. There's no political underpinnings to the word orientation when I'm using it. So regardless of any of that sort of sociocultural baggage, there is a scientific concept of an orientation, which involves the person having no control over, you know, what they are responding to or what they have developed to respond to. So, but oftentimes, unfortunately, the fact that a person has a psychosexual orientation just simply has these types of thoughts or desires or ruminations. Is enough for us to look at them and call them a pervert, for instance, or a sexual deviant, just because they have those thoughts. And it does make sense, you know, in particularly dangerous types of orientations like pedophilia or zoophilia, people who are attracted to animals, for instance, to know that the individual has these types of lustful desires and feelings. If you're a parent, you're going to want to have that information about somebody, even if they haven't ever acted on their desires. But that doesn't necessarily mean that we are morally, that we are somehow on ethically safe grounds to treat them unfairly or to stigmatize them as a pervert simply by virtue of those psychological states.
Well, these people are different from the norm, and their sexuality, in the case of pedophilia, I mean, this is something that is horrible, you know, if it's acted upon. Why is it wrong to call these people deviant? Is it wrong?
Well, I would take that back. I think it's wrong to call them perverts, because I think a pervert to me is somebody who actually intentionally acts on their sexual behaviors in a way that is demonstrably harmful to another. And not all pedophiles have already done that. There are some pedophiles, maybe it's the majority of pedophiles, we don't actually know the statistics, who recognize the fact that their orientation is something that is inherently harmful to children, and they are committed never to acting on those desires. And I think that they should be supported, helped not to cause harm to others. But I would say, you know, technically speaking, of course, they are sexually deviant, at least in the sense of their sexual thoughts. That I would imagine the majority of the human population is not attracted to prepubescent children for obvious adaptive reasons. It doesn't make a lot of sense from simply that sort of biological perspective. So we wouldn't think many people out there are predominantly aroused by prepubescents or you know, any more than we would to think that they were aroused by the elderly.
Right. They don't seem to be. This is Amy Alcorn's Advice Goddess Radio. My guest tonight is Dr. Jesse Baring, and his book we're discussing is Perv, the Sexual Deviant in All of Us. And you just mentioned briefly zoophilia. I hope I pronounced that right.
Zoophilia, yes.
And, thank you. And you write about that. And so if you're four and you're listening, cover your ears right now. So you, Jesse, are in favor of laws to protect animals vis-a-vis bestiality. But once again, you bring up the nuances and you say, and people have a problem with this, but this is, you know, something you get into, that there are cases of human-animal sex that don't involve any obvious harms to the animal and may even involve mutual pleasure. I haven't talked to the goat, but anyway, you bring up an interesting question. And you ask, which is worse, a stud manager forcibly collecting the semen of a prized racehorse by electro-ejaculating the animal for commercial gain? And this involves inserting an electrified rod into the animal's rectum and delivering a high-voltage shock to its prostate. That sounds really pleasant. Or, right, what about someone who is gently masturbating his companion horse for the sole intent of bringing it satisfaction? And you say the first, the thing about, like, sticking the thing in your racehorse's butt, you know, is it in the butt? Yeah. Yes. And, you know, and shocking him, you know, is legal. And that the second to, you know, if you think your horse is hot and you want to give it some satisfaction, that is not legal. So talk a little bit
right.
about that.
Well, we like to think that these protective laws are grounded in this principle of harm, preventing harm to vulnerable members of the population, whether it's children or the disabled or the elderly or animals. But there are contradictions, I think, in a lot of the laws, like some of the bestiality laws. So, for instance, the example that you've just given, that I give in the book about the stud manager electro-ejaculating his racehorse, well, that's completely legal, and it happens all the time. But it's quite obviously harmful. It hurts. And it's much more harmful than what the zoophilic woman is doing to her companion horse by gently masturbating it and bringing it to an orgasm, which isn't harmful at all. But what she's doing is illegal because technically it's bestiality. So to me, this is a lot of the residue of our you know, sort of religious-based prescriptions against certain types of sexual activity and our uncomfortableness with human beings being animals. And, you know, the dividing line between us and other species.
And it was interesting, you made the horse masturbator a woman when you were just talking about her. How many people, I mean, maybe there are no stats on this, participating in bestiality are women versus men?
That's a good question. There are women that engage in this, but like all of the different types of paraphilias or, you know, sexual orientations that are outside of the norm, it's overwhelmingly a male phenomenon.
Yeah, that's very interesting. And now, Jonathan Haidt, the psychologist, back in 2001, he coined the term moral dumbfounding. So talk about how this relates to your topic.
Well, oftentimes when we hear about deviant sexualities, we get turned off, you know, for obvious reasons. It's disgusting, or, you know, we wouldn't be particularly attracted or aroused by that type of thing. So it's gross. It feels wrong. We have no interest in doing it. And when somebody asks us why it's wrong, we kind of can't articulate or unpack our answers in any sort of rational, logical way. It's wrong because it's gross. It's wrong because God says no, something along those lines. There's no articulate, rational, moral framework on which our ethical evaluation is actually based. And, you know, I give a couple of examples in the book of where moral dumbfounding would be likely to be evoked or generated. And one would be the case of these adults, you know, they're twins. Yeah, they're gay porn stars, basically, in the Czech Republic. I think they're in their mid-20s. They perform in, you know, triple X-rated gay films with full anal penetration, and they've been doing that for a couple of years. But outside of the...
I just want to mention those two brothers, Milo and Elijah Peters, they are doing that on each other.
Oh, yeah,
just
sorry.
To make that clear.
I should have mentioned
that. Oh, yeah, no, that's okay. I'm here for that. I'm here for you.
Yeah. So the interesting thing is that outside of the porn studio, they're actually in a romantic relationship. They're dating each other. They consider themselves to be monogamous partners outside of their, you know, occupation. And they... You know, they say that they're completely in love, and apparently their family knows about this. The family is accepting of the relationship. They don't seem to be personally distressed by it. In all other ways, they seem reasonably well adjusted. And if you ask people if it's wrong, the majority of the population will say it's absolutely wrong. They shouldn't be doing this. But if you ask them to explain why they feel that way, they oftentimes struggle. They can't really give a good reason for why these 20-something-year-olds shouldn't be having anal sex with each other. They're not likely.
Right.
I mean, you can't. I mean, with incest, the most frequent explanation for why it's wrong is the harm-based one involving any potential offspring that would be subjected to some sort of genetic mutation. But obviously, reproduction is not a problem when we're talking about homosexual incest. So,
right. So
it's that visceral gut level feeling of moral dumbfounding, which Jonathan Haidt uses that term. You know, we feel in our stomach this sort of stomach-based philosophy that it's wrong, but we don't have a good reason when it comes to explaining ourselves.
Yeah, and this is a thing I really liked about your book, Perv, The Sexual Deviant in All of Us. I'm talking to Dr. Jesse Baring, the author of that book. Your book points out these things, these sort of irrational, not sort of, but these irrationalities in our thinking where we don't really check, okay, well, let me really look at that, because, of course, we don't want a brother and a sister to get together because the kid could have 4 ears and 3 heads. But, for these people, there's just this ick sense that people have. But really, they're not hurting anybody. They're not hurting society. And it's so interesting how we revert to those things. It's like rules of thumb, you know, these ick rules of thumb where we go to, oh, ick, no, that can't happen, when we don't really give it that much thought why we really think.
Yeah, and not only do we feel that, but we actually intervene and we actually, ruin other people's happiness because of our, our discomfort with their sexuality.
Right. Now, you write about that there are these shifts that go on in sexual trends that relate to what's in the news. This is something called framing, that we will we don't just think the same thing all the time, that based on what we're exposed to, we think differently. And you write that what's popular in sexuality, like whether the foot is eroticized, according to psychologist James Giannini, it seems to have something to do with whether there's been an outbreak of venereal disease.
Right. Which is, this is one of the more peculiar statistical trends that I uncovered in writing the book, which is that foot fetishism, or podophilia, which is the technical term for it, actually seems to flare up within a society when there are outbreaks of some sort of venereal disease. So, gonorrhea or syphilis, when there's an outbreak of some sort, historically, if you look at the trends, you see an increase in males' fascination or preoccupation in eroticizing the female foot. And his interpretation of this is basically that it's potentially some sort of adaptive mechanism that for men that would be able to acquire a paraphilia like foot fetishism more readily during these epidemic crises, they would be actually having less contact with the organs in the female body that would be, contributing or contaminating their loins. So if they're focusing their attention on the feet, basically they're having less actual intercourse. So as long as they're having enough intercourse to actually reproduce, their genes are still salvaged, but they're just not engaging as vigorously as they were before, or as somebody who doesn't have that type of fetish.
Now, you write about experiencing this, and I, very upsettingly, we used to give my two friends and I free advice in the street corner in Soho. People would offer us food and everything, and this guy said, oh, I'm training to be a masseuse, and I give you a free massage. He was this little guy, like a little elfin guy, so I thought, okay, he's so not my type, and he probably knows that, so I don't think he's going to, do anything, like massage the front or anything. And, oh, my God, the guy, all of a sudden, I feel my toe wet. And I was really freaked out. So what I want to know, and you probably, are curious about, is where does this come from? How do people get sexually turned on by a person's feet?
Yeah, and this was a hard thing for me to write about because I'm one of those people who actually finds feet absolutely revolting and disgusting. And
you have like hobbit feet or something.
My own feet, anyway. Yeah.
Right.
So, foot fetishism is surprisingly common, though. It's the most common form of partialism, a sexual partialism, where people get really turned on or enamored by a particular specific body part. So, there are partialists for the earlobes or the calves, the nipples, the lips, the, whatever sort of real estate there is on the body, but the most common form of partialist is the foot fetishist. And if you ask the adult foot fetishist, where did this come from? What's your earliest recollection of having these types of feelings or attraction to the foot? They'll oftentimes tell you that there was some sort of discrete moment or a series of discrete moments in their early childhood. And usually it's surprisingly young. It's between the ages of 4 and 9. Something happened, like they were wrestling with an older brother and the older brother's feet were flying in their face. Or they were giving their parents a massage, their mother a massage, a foot massage, and she was moaning in pleasure. something like that. They can tell you something quite specific. And, you know, they just happened to have an erection at the time, or they just were sort of incidentally aroused. And it was a permanent affair once that happened. The thing was locked in place, and from that point forward, they were a totophile and sort of an irrevocable, you know, sexual orientation at that point. It was just, there's nothing that they could do to eradicate it once it had developed. So, like all of the different paraphilias, there seems to be evidence for this process of sexual imprinting, at least in males. Something happens early in development, and again, it's pretty young, between the ages of 4 and 9, with maybe a couple of years at either end of that spectrum, that sets these things into motion.
Let me just have you backtrack a little. Tell us what a paraphilia is, and just to give you the dictionary definition from Jesse's book, outside of loving is where it comes from. So what is a paraphilia?
So a paraphilia is a clinical term. It's Latin for love outside of the norm, and it was coined by a German psychiatrist named Wilhelm Steckel. And he actually debated whether to call it a paraphilia or a paralognia. He preferred paralognia because the technical translation for paralognia is lust outside of the norm. And that's really what we're talking about here. We're talking about sexual arousal. We're really not talking about love or romance or anything like that. We're talking about just, you know, hot-blooded sexual feelings and desires. It's all about lust. A paraphilia is, you know, anything that is, you know, statistically unusual or abnormal. It's not always a psychiatric illness. It's only an illness if it harms somebody else. It's only diagnosed as an illness if it's harmful to somebody else or if it causes personal distress, which is a whole other can of worms. But there are at least 547 at last count distinct paraphilias on record, and foot fetishism is just one of them.
Well, doesn't fetishism, and you write about this, it's different from paraphilia. You say that the fetish object is exactly the erotic target, You say it's a symbolic stand-in for the real, you know, for the real erotic target, and like a panty bandit is a fetishist, and you know, and you say that brand new shoes never worn, they don't turn on the shoe fetishist. He'd only be interested in shoes that have been worn by somebody he finds appealing.
Right.
And I love this. You say if you fetishize men's underwear, you're not going to tear into the plastic wrapping of that crisp new pair of Fruit of the Looms.
Right. So, we use these words like kink and fetish and paraphilia oftentimes interchangeably, but there really are these fairly strict scientific definitions of the terms. Somebody who has a fetish, in particular an object fetish, is attracted to a category of object, not because they're aroused by the object in and of itself, but by virtue of the fact that an object has come into contact with the physical body of the person that they're aroused by. So they're using that object basically as a sexual surrogate for the person that they'd want to have sex with. So, you know, a man that's into panties, for instance, is not attracted to the panties in and of themselves, but he's attracted to panties worn by a particular woman or a type of woman that he finds appealing. So he's attracted to worn panties. There's some sort of essence. Some sort of essence that's been imbibed by the object itself. So that's what's arousing to the fetishist. It's the physical essentialist connection between the object and the contact of that object with the person's body.
And paraphilias, on the other hand, in the dictionary, they're a condition characterized by abnormal sexual desires typically involving extreme or dangerous activities. And you give some examples in the DSM-5, which is the Bible for Shrinks. And these include exhibitionism, fetishism, frotteurism, which, God, it's so gross, rubbing up on strangers in public. If you've taken the New York City subway, you suspect it's happening. Pedophilia, masochism, sadism, voyeurism, and transvestite fetishism. So these are all
those are the common ones. Yeah, those are
right.
The most common ones. But again, there are hundreds of them. And the vast majority of them we'd never hear of because they're either, you know, they're so unusual that, you know, two or three people in the entire world have them, you know, falling down the stairs and getting to get an orgasm or,
God, that would be awful.
Right, or the woman that, you know, she's an objectophile, she married the Eiffel Tower.
I love
things
that.
Like that. You know, these things are bizarre and carnivalesque, but they're not ostensibly harmful. Well, you might be careful when you're falling down the stairs, I guess, but they're not harmful to anybody else, at least.
Right.
So there are object-related paraphilias, and fetishism is actually a subtype of paraphilia. But there are also activity-oriented paraphilias, and these are things like exhibitionism, as I mentioned, or sadism, where there's some sort of behavior that the person has to engage in to get off.
You're disappearing a little bit, so lean into your phone a little bit. Another example you give, which I've heard of before, the guy who's into amputees, that's an example of paraphilia.
Right, so that's acrotomophilia, and these are people. Then you know there are gatherings of them. There are followings online of people who are into amputees. It's a whole, you know, genre of porn related, you know, amputee fetishism. If you ask these people where did your attraction to amputees come from, many of them can tell you that they either knew somebody when they were a child, some attractive woman that lived next door, for instance. There was one guy whose father was a physician, and his first sexual experience was looking through his physician father's textbook and seeing naked images of women that happened to have amputations. That was his first exposure to a naked woman.
I'm laughing because I remember early in the book that you confess a number of your embarrassing experiences. One is that your first sexual experience was it involved a Neanderthal in one of your father's anthropology textbooks. So
yeah,
it's a good thing.
A textbook.
Yeah. Right, they're not around anymore, that you're not really stuck on Neanderthals because they'd be real hard to find these days.
I know. Well, there's a guy in the guy in the Geico commercials, I think that was the last. I see him every once in a while. Gets me a little bit excited. But yeah, they're not too common these days.
Right. Yeah, it's pretty amazing. And you say that paraphilia.
But I should also say that nobody knows why, you know, one person develops a fetish or paraphilia and the other person doesn't, even though they have, you know, basically identical or very similar developmental experiences. So there's a lot of mystery surrounding the cause or the origins of abnormal sexuality. And one of the reasons is the fact that you can't do good controlled experiments, laboratory studies, where you've got like a, you know, of infants, and you assign them to the control group, and they have the normal development, and then you've got the experimental group of infants, and you systematically manipulate features of their early childhood to see, you know, if that's the cause of, you know, some type of paraphilia, and you wait for 18 years and see who grows up to be a sexual deviant. You just can't
right.
do that ethically, of course, and for good
right.
you know, for good reasons.
Well, I would wonder, you know, the twins research, suggests that 50% of our behavior is genetic. I think they say 20% is environmental. Ooh, and I'm going to forget what the other. 40% is environmental, and 10%. I'm forgetting that part. My memory's on the fritz. But basically, you know, some of this, it seems to be, you know, epigenetics is how the genes and our environment interplay. And I would think that some people would maybe be more susceptible to this. And very interestingly, you write that paraphilias are overwhelmingly a male phenomenon, and that experts report a sex difference ratio is, you know, there are 99 paraphilic men to every paraphilic woman. So that's pretty amazing.
Right, and here we're talking about, you know, actual clinical diagnoses of paraphilic conditions where the only way for the individual or the only easy way for the individual actually to have an orgasm or to be sexually gratified is through that very specific act or to be with a particular type of person or an animal or some sort of object. that delivers that pleasure. Women, you know, you talked about that earlier. Women are much more flexible in terms of what can potentially arouse them. They're less likely to be locked into something that specific. They have this quality of what Meredith Chivers calls erotic plasticity.
Right, and her study, I've written about this in my column too, where she hooked women up to this arousal machine and found that while men, you know, men might say, I'm straight, you know, and then they'd be turned on by the gay stuff, and we'd, you know, think, because men are pretty clear about what they're into, that, okay, guess what, you're lying, but that women were turned on by women having sex, men having sex, even if they were heterosexual or thought they were or claimed to be, but they also were turned on by bonobos, these apes, having sex too, and
when you say turned on, on, it's not necessarily at a conscious level. Oftentimes, they're not even aware of the fact that they're just displaying the sort of genital arousal to the images in front of them. So there's a disconnect between their genitals and their, you know, their erotic brain or their consciousness. Whereas for men, men know what turns them on. You know, whether they want to share that with other people or not is a different story. But it's pretty clear to them, at least, what arouses them most.
Right, and this is an important point. It's genital arousal. You know, these women don't want to go out, you know, for a beer with a bonobo. You actually, this is so interesting. You have a very you write about this very interesting interpretation about why women may have a wider range of arousal, and this is from psychologist Samantha Dawson, and she said that in evolutionary times, she pointed out that the cost of not responding genitally to sexual cues could, you know, it was very high for women. You know, they could have vaginal tears or ecchymosis, which leads to infertility. So it was important that, look, you big ape, you know, okay, you're going to hold me down. And, you know, even if I don't want this to happen, I need to have my sex parts, you know, let you in so I won't be damaged forever in terms of fertility, which would be evolutionarily extremely costly. Oh, Jesse, you fell into a tunnel. Are you there? Okay, keep talking, but I think you fell into a tunnel. So are you there? Okay, we might need you to call back on your cell phone. Let's see if I'm gonna get into next the cannibal pop. Okay, oh, there you are. Oh, hello. Okay, I'm going to answer that if I can find it. Oops, uh-oh. I think I just lost you. Okay, Jesse, you there? Sorry about that. Jesse, I hung up by accident instead of, are you there? Jesse, uh-oh. Need to call back. We're going to talk about, Jesse, my guest tonight is Dr. Jesse Baring. His book is Perv, the Sexual Deviant in All of Us. It seems I'm the only person left here who's going to call back. He talks about this unbelievable case of the cannibal cop. This is called vorophilia, from the Latin, to swallow or devour. This guy, he actually wanted to, his thing that he liked sexually was to eat somebody else, and he actually managed to find somebody else who was into this as well. Let's see. Hopefully Jesse's calling back, but I have some notes on this, so I'll tell you about what he said. This is New York City police officer Gilberto Val, and he was found guilty of this. He planned to kidnap, murder, and eat a woman. And then there was this guy, I think he was, he was German. He was a cannibalistic sexual sadist. In the spring of 2001, he found this willing sexual masochist for himself, Bernd Jürgen Brandes. And he wrote, looking for a well-built 18 to 30-year-old to be slaughtered and then consumed. I mean, and there's a website, Cannibal Cafe. This is really incredible. Jesse's back. Jesse, hi. Sorry about that. Are you there? Jesse? Hello, Jesse? Hello, Jesse. Okay, oops.
Hello.
Jesse, hi. Hello. Okay,
hi.
Great, you're back. I've just been talking about the cannibal cop, reading a little bit about out of your book about the ad, Miwa's personal ad. And then there's this guy who answered it who wanted to be digested. You know, this vorophilia, you know, this is really incredible. The guy wasn't coerced. The person who wanted to be eaten, he didn't have to be coerced at all.
He actually had to talk the guy into doing it. He's the one that wanted to be eaten.
it's really incredible. So, I mean, this is an incredible case. You know, these kinds of things. Any idea of how this came to be this guy's turn on?
No. I mean, I think it's clear enough for most people that there's some sort of psychiatric disturbance with anybody who would either want to eat or be eaten by somebody else for sexual reasons. But there's no telling. I mean, it's obviously at the extreme end of the sadomasochistic scale. And I think most practitioners of BDSM today would not affiliate or want to be affiliated with anything quite that severe in terms of pain and torture and suffering.
And just explain, in case anybody doesn't know, what BDSM is.
Bondage, discipline, sadomasochism. You know, these are people that either are sexually aroused by administering some sort of pain or suffering, or being on the receiving end of that. You know, 50 Shades of Grey is probably the best cultural example today, but even that is kind of BDSM light, I would say. And, you know, most of the time, people that are into some sort of BDSM are either simulating the pain, or the pain is not, it's not really that significant. It's not something that would actually warrant a trip to the emergency room, for instance. Or that, you know, there's some sort of mutual agreement about, you know, what is enough or what is too much, or some sort of signaling to broadcast when somebody has gone over the line.
And now just talk directly into your phone, because we have you going in and out a little bit still on the cell phone.
Okay.
So you just mentioned 50 Shades of Grey. People, you write, have long been freaked out by the aroused female. And there were actually clitoridectomies. Didn't just happen in Africa. You know, these were actually going on in many places. And masturbation, hilariously, was prescribed back in the 1600s, you know, as, okay, you're some kind of you know, nymphomaniac, and we're going to have to cure that. We're going to have someone masturbate you.
Madness from the womb, yeah.
Right.
Yeah, yeah. So, I mean, as recently as 100 years ago, there were clitoridectomies that were being performed, like you said, in New York and Paris for teenage girls that were caught by their parents masturbating. You know, something as normal and everyday and routine for adolescents was seen as some sort of moral sickness or illness. And they took drastic measures to eradicate the problem, and it really wasn't even a problem, of course. So, our view of female sexuality, I think, is probably the best example of a very significant cultural shift in a short period of time.
Well, and this is very evolutionarily driven, I would suspect, you know, because women hold the power. We're the ones who have the babies. And now our genes, of course, are very antique, and they don't really know from birth control being invented, reliable birth control. But, you know, that people, I think that the reason for being so freaked out had to do with the women having the babies. But, you know, even about Casanova, you write, one person's sexual exorbitance is another slow Monday morning. And you say that normal is still an interesting number, comparing a normal sex drive to a hypersexual sex drive. You know, that Kinsey, in his book that he published in 1948, Sexual Behavior in the Human Male, he said that data showed that 75% of American males are technically sex deviants, you know, according to the criteria at the time. So what's normal? What's considered normal now, quote unquote, normal for men and for women?
Well, I mean, I still think that we do have the evolutionarily based construct of normal. I still think that's a fairly good one. It's a useful measure of normal, which is, you know, normal is heterosexual sex that leads to, you know, reproduction, and that's a sort of adaptive strategy for most mammalian species. But that's not to say that normal is good or bad. Normal is just a number. So heterosexuality is normal. Homosexuality, for instance, I would consider to be sexually deviant, but deviant only in that statistical sense, not in the morally loaded sense of the term.
Right.
So I do think that the normal has its value. It's just that it's been abused by spilling over into the ethical and moral topics of discussion where it doesn't belong.
Yeah, and you're right, actually, gay men in particular are dinged by it's wrong because it's gross. And
yeah, the moral compounding.
Right, discussed how, you know, what we are disgusted by is easier sold as abnormal, And in fact, it can even, disgust can even make us express, you know, people who aren't normally intolerant express bigoted views if they're presented with something, you know, like in Cornell where they had the undergrads assigned to the stink and no stink conditions, and then they had to complete a survey. So, and those that who were assigned the stink condition expressed more disapproval toward gay men than those in the no stink condition.
Right. So it seems that when you somehow cause somebody to be disgusted, and then you expose them to different types of sexual behaviors, they're more likely to find the sexually deviant behaviors morally wrong when they're disgusted. So somehow there is a meaningful relationship, it seems, between disgust and arousal. You know, we do lots of disgusting things in bed, but it doesn't seem as disgusting to us as it does when we are, you know, when we're not aroused. So when we get aroused first, then the things that are disgusting seem a little bit less disgusting and allow us to do it in terms of interacting with each other's disgusting body parts and fluids and so on.
Yeah, and that framing is very interesting because you write about some research where they show that people were not disgusted by those things when they didn't get presented with the disgusting stuff. They were okay with the sexually, quote-unquote, disgusting things, but not okay with the things that we normally find disgusting, like parasites and dog poop and everything like that.
Yeah. So there are a couple of interesting studies in that area. I mean, one of the more interesting pieces of data was a study by Dan Fessler at UCLA, where he looked at women's disgust-related responses and women that were at different phases of the menstrual cycle. And he found that when women were at the peak of fertility in terms of their risk of conception, they viewed deviant things, sexually deviant behaviors like having sex with an elderly partner or having sex with an animal or having sex with a relative. They found those things to be more disgusting compared to women that were less likely to conceive at different stages of their reproductive cycle. So he thought that this was some sort of adaptive strategy where, when the risk were the greatest in terms of likelihood of conceiving or wasting opportunities for conception, that women are going to be much more selective and judgmental in the sexual domain.
Right. I've actually read that. I know Dan and Dave Navarette who did that with him. And yeah. I think they called it biologically suboptimal union. So you're not going to
right.
be, you know, you're not going
Very
to get the best
term.
Kid. Yeah, right. You're not going to get the best kid from the, you know, the old dude, you know. And so that was very, very interesting. And also, this is so fascinating. You talk about disgust having powerful symbolic elements. And you write that sexual assault victims, they report the strong impulse to wash afterward. And a quarter of those people are still who have been sexually assaulted wash up for 3 months later. And you say that when symbolic disgust gets into your core identity, that this process of psychological sanitation is never easy.
Right. So, and, you know, I think that a lot of us have an image of some, you know, woman who's just been sexually assaulted or raped. You know, she's in the shower scrubbing herself clean. She can't get clean. But that actually happens. You know, women do experience that feeling that they've somehow been contaminated. And you know, when that happens, I think it is even, you know, it's much more powerful and destructive than even physical contaminants, that sort of symbolic feeling of what is disgusting. And, you know, the interesting thing to me, though, is that category of symbolic disgust seems to be the product of one's enculturation experiences. What elicits that feeling of symbolic disgust in the sexual domain varies from culture to culture. You know, what we would feel in terms of being tainted by something sexual and feeling gross and disgusting symbolically and getting into our core identity like that, you know, another society in the middle of Africa, for instance, or South America, they wouldn't experience that shame or feeling of disgust at all.
Right. I realize that's happening in Downton Abbey right now. I'm embarrassed to admit that. But
I wouldn't know that.
I figured you wouldn't. So you have this wonderful last chapter on what's called theory of mind, which is basically, well, I'll let you explain. What is theory of mind?
Well, it's a term basically for advanced social cognition. A theory of mind is the theory of unobservable psychological states. So if you were in front of me, you know, sitting in front of me, I would just basically see your body. I would be moving about in different ways and nodding your head and rolling your eyes or something like that. But I couldn't literally see your mind. I can only develop a theory of why you're behaving the way that you are. So I have a theory of your mental states. That's what a theory of mind is. It allows us to get into the head of somebody else, to take their perspective, to put ourselves into their shoes, to simulate their experiences. And it seems to be, if not completely unique to human beings, at least a social cognitive ability that we have developed a highly specialized capacity for.
Yeah, and one thing that I have given as an example on previous shows, that an example of this at work is that when a man across the street bends down on one knee, and, you know, is talking to a woman, we don't think that he's going to ask her for a pen. You know, so we have these ideas, you know, based on things we've experienced and what we know from our culture. But you talk about how we sometimes guess wrong about what's going on in somebody's mind. You give this example of an incident on a crowded subway.
Mm-hmm.
Do you remember that one?
I don't have it in front of me, but I think that if we if you're on a crowded subway and all of a sudden somebody that's another passenger on the train begins screaming or physically assaulting another passenger, we immediately jump to some sort of conclusion about why that person did what they did, and I think most people, they would just assume that the individual is crazy, something is wrong with that person, they're unpredictable. They've got some sort of mental disorder that led them to be that violent. So we're going to try to get away from them as quickly as possible. So you're not going to take out a notebook and, you know, write down our theories about why that person did what he just did. It's going to be an immediate intuitive judgment about their mental state or their mental functioning. But,
right.
Sometimes we're completely wrong. You know, we've devised this hypothesis that this guy is mentally disturbed, and that's why he just, hit the guy that's sitting near him all of a sudden. But, you know, then we find out all of a sudden, you know, there's a woman in the scene now, and she's screaming at the guy that's just been attacked, and she's accusing him of, you know, touching her daughter. He's a frauderist.
Right. You give this example of this. The guy on the train is this well-dressed man. He's, you know, Mr. like silver hair, beautiful suit, you know, and this teenage daughter is shouting at the guy. And then this sort of, you know, guy who looks like the, you know, homeless guy, filthy and disturbed looking. He, you know, is the one who goes after this guy. But it turns out that this guy, the homeless looking guy, was actually defending this teenage girl against the guy who, you know, this sort of well-dressed man who is the fraturist, you know, the guy who is rubbing up against her on the train. And so we have these preconceived notions about many things, and they affect us sexually. And you talk about how this, you know, affects us in bed, you know, and that how it can actually, you know, being able to, you know, it's like not being able to reason about another person's thoughts, those can bring with it a feeling of, you know, sexual shame or have us impose that on them.
Yeah, knowing that somebody else is somehow thinking about your sexuality, and if your sexuality is socially inappropriate or something like that, that can induce these feelings of shame. And if this, you know, theory of mind is something that is, for the most part, qualitatively unique to human beings, then that feeling of sexual shame and ostracism and stigma is probably going to be fundamentally unique to us as well. So there is a downside to theory of mind when it comes to our sex lives, but I think there are also positive aspects of it as well. And one is the fact that it allows, if we're in a healthy sexual relationship with a consenting adult partner, it allows us to take their perspective and engage basically in lovemaking. You know, our sexual behaviors with another person could last, you know, for a very long time compared to other species that have sex. If you look at chimpanzees or even bonobos, it's basically just sort of this sort of hodgepodge of, you know, loins coming together in a rash in three minutes or less. With a human relationship, it could last for up to an hour. So, and you can synchronize your orgasms and all sorts of things like that. But you have to be able to take the perspective of the person you're having sex with and be able to appreciate that they're feeling what you're feeling.
Yeah, that's really, really important. Well, we are out of time. I wanted to, by the way, thank all the people. We had a number of people who called in. I'm so sorry I couldn't take your calls. They just came a little late in the show. And, Jesse, we have like 2 minutes left. And I just wanted to ask you to leave us with some final words. And before you do, let me just say this is Advice Goddess Radio, Amy Alcon, syndicated columnist. And my guest tonight has been Dr. Jesse Baring. And his book we've been discussing is Perv, the Sexual Deviant in All of Us. So give us some parting words, of advice.
Well, I mean, I guess I'll just tell you what I think is the big message of the book, and to reiterate that, which is the fact that, you know, we are too preoccupied, spending too much time thinking and worrying about what is normal and what is natural. And these are really hollow questions. These are not terribly philosophically meaningful questions. In terms of making any moral progress, I think we've got to move away from that and get to this issue and get a better grasp on the issue of harm. Defining harm, understanding harm is different for different people, and being able to demonstrate it when we're actually accusing somebody of causing harm to somebody else because of their sexuality. So I guess I'll leave it at that. Thank you very much for having me on the show.
Oh, thank you. You're really fantastic. This is a great show. I've been talking to Jesse Baring, author of Perv. Thanks again.
You work at Westcom?
Yes.
So you can get me in?
Huh?
Can you get me on the list to join? I've heard Westcom offers all the great service, low fees, and great rates of a credit union.
That's right. Plus all the tools you get from a big bank.
So I need to be on the VIP list?
No. Anyone in SoCal can open a Westcom account. You'll even get perks, like access to 30,000 fee-free ATMs.
I feel